Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Plus972 Studio, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. And it is Freedom Day today. And we seem to have got a bit of freedom from the rain for just a little bit, which has been very nice because it has been pouring with rain and beautiful and lovely. And we need the rain, but we also need a break from the rain, especially if you want to get your clothes dry. So, yeah, that is what is today. And as I look out the window, I see there are some clouds gathering, but it is, in fact, a beautiful autumn day here in the city of Johannesburg and on 101.9 Chai FM, wherever you're listening. And even if maybe where you're listening there isn't Freedom Day going on. So what are we going to be talking about today on the show? Well, great lineup, as usual. We are going to be talking Freedom Day. What does Freedom Day mean today? What should we think about it? We're going to talk about America and what they think about Freedom Day, because they issued us with a Freedom Day congratulations from the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio himself. So we will think about what do the Americans think of this. And we're talking Mopani worms. I don't know if any of the listeners here have ever eaten Mopani worms, because they're not super kosher, because they're worms. But we're going to be talking about it. And what do Mopani worms contribute to South Africa, and particularly our rural communities? If you've ever been up north to Limpopo, Mpumalanga, you will see in the places the people selling the Mopani worms. So we're looking at what is the economy of the Mopani worm. And then I'm excited. We have in studio, in the second half of the show, we've got the Israeli national mountain biking champion, Naama Neumann, and she is going to be talking to us about her journey towards competing in the Olympics. So that's a fascinating discussion, and one which I'm very excited about. And then lastly, it is the Omer, so we have some a cappella music. I call it alpaca music just because it sounds cooler, but I don't think there's any actual alpacas. But, you know, someone was complaining to me the other night that a cappella music is boring and it's always a little bit like sad and whatever. So I've picked an a cappella song for you for the Omer, which I hope will be super, super interesting. And that's coming up towards the end of the show. So if you want to hear that, you do stay tuned. And perhaps as importantly, do stay in touch. We do want to hear from you. It might be a public holiday, but that does not allow you, as the listeners, to abrogate your role helping us along with the conversation, which if you do want to be part of it, 061-895-1019. And you can tell us anything you want, but I would be interested to hear if we have listeners out there who have eaten a Mopani worm before. I'd like to hear what you think of it. I have never eaten a Mopani worm myself, but I once did. It's like some sort of cultural day thing, and you had like all these different groups and whatever. It was like at university, and there were all these like different communities, and you could try their different foods. And I went to the Congolese stand, and they said, yeah, you can try this. So I tried it, thinking it was some sort of vegetarian stew, and there was something in it. It was a little bit wiggly, and it was very hot and very awful. And I've never forgotten it. So that was my, I don't know if it was a Mopani worm, but it was definitely a Congolese one. So yeah, it was hectic. Anyway, I would like to hear from you, 061-895-1019. I'm Benji Shulman. This is Plus972 Studio. We will be back just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Manji Shulman, and this is Studio Plus972. Hope you are doing supremely well out there and enjoying your Freedom Day, however you're enjoying it. It's going to be a bit of a short week because, of course, it's May Day on Friday. So if you're trying to get some work in this week, May Day, May Day, May Day. Anyway, let's talk about these public holidays, because people think that we have a lot of public holidays, which we do. We don't have the most. If you look around the world, there's some places like Iceland that have close to like 20, I think, 17, something like that. We have about 13 or 14. 12, around that number. So we don't have the most, but we don't have the least either. We do have a sizable chunk. And for whatever reason, they also seem to cluster, right? So this time of the year around April, you get a lot of them. That has to do with somewhat religious aspects, some political. There's a bunch in December, and then there's like one or two that sort of pop up throughout the year. Now, if you look at our public holidays, you can kind of cluster them into four sections, right? You can kind of cluster them into four sections, and they are you can cluster them in the following. The one is kind of religious holidays, so that's your Easters, your Christmases. You can kind of fold New Year's into that because it's kind of like a secular holiday. So you got your religious holidays. Then we have your miscellaneous ones, and so those ones are often just put down to help people with the religious ones so that they can have a full holiday or something like that. So for example, you have Family Day, which we used to call Easter Monday, which comes after Easter Friday. There's what we used to call Boxing Day. So there's a few of those. And those are part of it. Then there's a bunch that came through because of the transition that we had in South Africa, where you had to sort of accommodate ones that were really already on the calendar. So one of those is the 16th of December. It used to be Dingaan's Day. There was Day of the Vow, and then it became Day of Reconciliation. And you had to accommodate that particular one because it was very important to the Afrikaners. And then what we call now Heritage Day used to be Shaka's Day. So that had to kind of accommodate the Zulu nationalists. So they put it into the calendar. But all the other ones that we have commemorate events, political events, really in the history of the struggle. So that is the shooting at Sharpeville. That's now Human Rights Day. You've got 16th of June coming up. That's got to do with the Soweto uprising. You've got May Day, which is to do with the communists in our country. So these are all things that are put into the calendar to commemorate days. But what's interesting about it is the days actually also represent kind of political philosophies, because they were all driven by different groups. So, for example, the Soweto Uprising Youth Day was not an ANC phenomenon. It was actually a part of the Black Consciousness Movement. And Human Rights Day, which is the Sharpeville shooting, that had to do with the PAC and the Pan-Africanists. So that was quite important. And then there is another another one, which is I'm trying to think which are the other political ones that we have. I suppose if you think about it, the Zulus and Afrikaans ones is also there. But basically, I'm trying to think which one. Oh, Women's Day is actually commemorates the Women's March in August. And that was actually very much a kind of ANC Congress-led one. So everyone kind of has their day, and it's all connected to a political philosophy. Even the ones that we've sort of had to accommodate are Afrikaans nationalism, Zulu nationalism. So really, when you're taking a public holiday, most of the time you're taking it for a religious purpose, or because of a religious purpose, you're getting an extra day because South Africans don't like to work too hard, and that's good for us. I'm happy with that. And then you're actually engaging in a kind of philosophy, even though we've changed it a bit over time. Like, I don't think, for example, Heritage Day, anyone thinks of it as like a Shaka Day or whatever. People pitch up in the different heritage outfits, whatever. We've sort of done it ourselves. But they all come with this big narrative, which brings me to Freedom Day. So what does Freedom Day represent? It represents the first democratic election after 1994. And kind of, it's also not the same, but it's kind of concurrently connected with the adoption of the Constitution. I think when people talk about it, there is a different constitutional day. And of course, we have Mandela Day or whatever, but those are not public holidays. And so what is what does this represent? Well, one of the things we need to understand is that in the run-up to the end of apartheid, you had these two competing forces, right? You had the Afrikaans nationalists and the NP, and they had all the guns, and they were very determined, and they didn't want to give up power. And then you had the ANC, who didn't really have any guns, and but they did have world opinion on their side, and they were pushing a boycott of things. And so they were slowly but surely bankrupting the apartheid government at the same time. And this meant that no one knew quite where it was going to end. And the kind of, if we're going to talk about a miracle in South Africa, one of the miracles that we had was that we had these two leaders. The one was Nelson Mandela, and the other one was F.W. de Klerk. And they realized that everyone could keep fighting for another 10 years, but it would mean a proper civil war, and that would mean the destruction of the country, and that once the Soviet Union fell, then the ANC no longer had any political support from the outside world, and then that meant that the Western powers wouldn't refuse to have anything more to do with South Africa, because they were basically running interference, even though they didn't really like the racist regime, because they were concerned that the gold was going to fall into the hands of the communists. And so once all those forces and the negotiations started, no one was going to get what they wanted. Under the ANC, they wanted to nationalize everything and do some sort of Soviet-style revolution, socialism like we had in Zimbabwe and Mozambique and Namibia, all the countries around us and whatever. And the nationalists were like, okay, well, can we hold on to power for a little bit longer and do some sort of minority rights in their own homeland and all of that? And that they didn't get that either. And so out of this, what they ended up choosing was a kind of liberal a liberal framework, which is the constitution, it's the elections, it's the parliament, it's free press, it's freedom of association, all these things that we kind of take for granted. All come about because it was a system which could allow everyone a part of the discussion. And as a result, we end up with that. And so actually, Freedom Day is kind of a holiday of the liberals of the country who understood that there was a requirement for everyone to sit down and talk, and who had had this relationship going back for many, many years. So that, for me, is the meaning of Freedom Day and why we should hold on to it, because it's now the thing that makes South Africa South Africa, and we should carry on with that, and we will do carry on with that conversation just after this.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
101.9 Hi FM, I am Benji Schulman, and this is Studio Plus 972. I hope that you're doing super well out there and are enjoying your Freedom Day. And by the way, the Americans actually did wish us a happy Freedom Day. So I'm going to read that out for you in just a moment. And you'll be able to get a sense about what they wanted to convey to us on that day. But Bianca has sent us a message. Thank you so much, Bianca. It says, good afternoon. We need a few days of properly warm weather suitable for all, but I see it's possible rain for tomorrow. I wouldn't eat a worm. It's just not encouraging. I think the education system towards existing farmers whom students study agriculture can grow towards them. So thank you, Bianca, talking about the question of the Mopani worms, which we will get onto in just a second. But let me read for you, if you haven't heard just yet, what the Americans think of Freedom Day. Just before the break, we were talking about Freedom Day. And so this... I don't know if there's like a drum roll. Craig's not here, so I can't give you the drum roll of what the Americans have to say. But they have to say the following. April 27th, 2026 press statement on South African Freedom Day by Marco Rubio, Secretary of State of the United States of America, says, on behalf of the United States of America, I extend warm greetings to the people of South Africa as you commemorate Freedom Day. Over three decades since South Africa's democratic transition, this occasion provides an opportunity to reflect on the country's history and future. As we look ahead, we remain open to constructive engagements where our interests align. So it's, I would say, deeply warm It's not wildly exciting, but it is a it is something, and it still shows that the Americans are keeping an open door to South Africa. And I see we've put this ambassador in now, Rolf Meyer. I don't know if he's going to be able to get anything done. Certainly, he's a competent human being. Certainly has the trust of Uncle Cyril, which is very important these days as an ambassador. I mean, if you look, for example, at the American ambassador that's been sent now to South Africa, Brent Bazell III, he has many good qualifications, don't get me wrong, but he's not a traditional diplomat. And his main thing is that he actually has the ear of President Trump. And I think that Rolf Meyer will probably have the ear of Uncle Cyril. And so that is a really important thing. You know, you want to have someone who has the ear of the president so that we can get things done and hopefully repair the relations and convey messages in an effective way. So hopefully, it's a positive step. And this thing, it shows that the Americans are still interested in talking to us. And hopefully we can find a way for everyone to get what they want out of this relationship. In particular, the Americans are concerned about the Kill the Boer song and farm murders. They're worried about the ICJ case with Israel. They're worried about South Africa's connection to Iran. They're worried about BEE. And they're worried about people wanting to expropriate property without compensation, which is the South African legal push which has been had. So that is that. And that is what we are doing, and that is what the Americans have to say about the whole conversation. So there we go. Now, I promised you a discussion about the Barney worm, so here it comes. Not too many people seem to have eaten it because they haven't messaged us, but this the story comes from a geographer, so someone close to my heart, who he's at the University of Johannesburg, and he's done some studies into the economy of Mopani worms in rural South Africa. So his name is Ndazulia. This guy's not going to be happy that I'm butchering his name. Ndizulafi Innocent Sintamule. Where is Makundi when you need him to do translations? Anyway, so that's his name. And he is a researcher at the University of Johannesburg. And he has done a study where he says that in rural parts of South Africa, close to Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Mozambique, we have some very poor provinces. And this guy's research looks at sustainable environmental outcomes and the role of local culture and sacred sites and community practices in managing resources. And in two studies, he's explored the commercializing of Mopani worms. So the process, he said, looks at the Mopani worms, which are nutritious and high protein delicacy in Limpopo. And he's also looked at the harvesting and commercialization of termites. And these resources are important for food security and poverty relief. And Mopani worms and termites offer both high-quality nutrition and substantial income-generating opportunities for rural households. And both are traded in local and regional markets, both formal and informal. And the enterprise is largely driven by unemployment and economic hardship and the need for cash. And so what does it look like to do this sort of thing? So Mopani worm study was done in 2023 in the Mopani district, which is where the words are from. And this area is dominated by Mopani woodlands. And the trees are the main food of the Mopani worms, which are kind of caterpillar, if you've never actually seen one. And these villages don't have a lot from development, and so people depend very heavily on the Mopani worm. And the processing basically works in the following. So first they have to squeeze the Mopani worm to get rid of the insides, because that's not so tasty apparently. Then they get washed and boiled and dried, and then they are stored for long periods. And then they're graded and sold. And this study actually looked at 160 households in villages in the area, and the questions covered socioeconomic issues as well as the process of marketing the Mopani worms. And what's interesting is they found that most of the harvesters, 69% and 59% in some of the villages, were women, which is, I suppose, what you would expect. And almost all of them processed the worms at home. And they collected the worms for household consumption and trade. And those who traded the worms reported making, now listen to this, between 1,000 Rand and 3,000 Rand per season. So there are two major Mopani worm seasons, from November to January and from April to May. And they managed to get, if you had a good season, basically 1,000 Rand a month. And the study found that 55% of households in the one village and 70% in another derived income exclusively from Mopani worm sales. So this is literally the only thing that is keeping people eating in those areas, excluding people who were over 60 and got social grants, or pensioners grants, or for children. And the income from, although the income from the Mopani worms is seasonal, communities very much appreciated and contributed to rural livelihoods, and it's also a source of food and cash income. And then there's a whole a bunch of stuff about the question of the termites as well, there's a range of indicators, similar kind of discussion around the termites and what they contribute to the Mopani, to the rural economy, essentially. So, and what's interesting is that the communities there understand that the Mopani worms can be kind of, you know, fished out, if you like. Like they can be, they can actually be over consumed. So they have rules in place. So you're not allowed to cut green branches, which affects the worms. They're restricted to harvesting during specific times, and you're not allowed to damage trees during the Mopani worm harvest. And this kind of stuff can be used to actually help authorities regulate and support the Mopani worm industry in those communities. So if you're interested in it, you can go check out Mopani Worms and Termite Sales Relieve Poverty in Rural South Africa. Studies explore the impact. And this is by Innocent Sintomule from the University of Johannesburg. So there we go. That is that. If you're interested in the Mopani worm economy, that is what is happening. We will be back in just a few moments on the opposite end of this particular.
High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
101.9 Chai FM. This is Studio Plus 972. Welcome to the show on this Freedom Day afternoon. And you might have heard in one of Howard's shows that he was talking to the head or the winner or the, how would you describe it, but the number one person when it came to Israeli mountain biking. And so I thought, no, we have to have her on the show twice because you know, Howard, I don't know, I'll just do a better job, it's fine. And we're just excited to have her in the studio. It's really interesting when we have someone from Israel who's coming to South Africa, who's doing things and who's doing amazing things. So we just had to get her into the studio. Her name is Naama Neumann, and she is a mountain biker all the way from Israel. Naama, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
So let's, before we get into your history or whatever, you've been here doing a bunch of races, including some really tough ones. So just talk to us about that, in particular for people who want to understand the actual biking side of things.
Right. So I started in the Cape Epic, mm-hmm. On the other side. And then because of the situation, I actually couldn't get home. So we decided to make lemonade and do some more racing. And then it was three races, two in Namibia and now one here yesterday. And that was cross country, so it's the Olympic discipline where I am the national champion in Israel.
Amazing, amazing. Now, the Cape Epic has quite a serious reputation, both for being quite beautiful, but also for being quite tough. So how did you find that?
That's absolutely the toughest mountain bike race in the world. It's on the bucket list of every real mountain biker. It was a dream come true to just be invited and race it. In the elite category, you have to be invited. You cannot just register. So I was really happy to get this invitation for the first time in my career and took it. And it definitely exceeded my expectation. It was, first of all, very, very beautiful and very, very, very tough. We had a goal of reaching to the top 10 in the general classification, and we did that. So we finished very happy on a high. I'll definitely do it again. I'm not sure in the next 2 years, but yeah.
Unbelievable. Okay, so that's that's that. Now talk about this one that you did in Johannesburg. You said that's part of your discipline for the Olympics. And what you're doing is you're not just running around the world or cycling around the world in different races. There is a point to all of this stuff because you're trying to get to the Olympics, which is coming up in 28, no?
Yep. Correct.
So explain to us how this would look different from the Cape Epic and how this works towards, you know, how do you get into the Olympics as a biker?
Right. So the Cape Epic was a great physical preparation. It made me happy, the sponsors happy. It was very good. But at the end, it's not adding to the ranking classification for the Olympics. So the Olympics, you qualify by points. And every race I do in the next 2 years will bring me points to this ranking. So when I race here, like in Johannesburg yesterday, we had the cross country race, and it's 1.5 hours full gas in a very technical, tough terrain, steep up and down, very hectic, all out. And that's the races that will define who is going to the Olympics.
So what made you want to get into this stuff in the first place? Because, you know, in my very, very limited mountain biking experience, which I think is probably one or two times I've ever gotten a mountain bike, mostly what I remember is falling down into the mud and getting scratches and bruises. But I'm assuming that's not what the experience is if you actually know what you're doing.
Well, I didn't fall today, but I was definitely covered in mud in the ride. But no, I grew up on a mountain bike and I fell in love with this and everything that it gave me and the sensations. And it became very quickly a dream, a national dream, to place a woman mountain biker in the Olympics. And we still didn't get to do that as a nation. We never had in the Olympics on the start line a woman mountain biker. So that's what I'm trying to do. I have my name written on that. We were very, very, very close to reach it in Paris, as close as can be, a heartbeat away from qualifying. But now we're gonna get to it in LA.
Well, if you want to ask them any questions, excuse me, you can WhatsApp us 061-895-1019 if you have any questions for her. Now, the truth is that you didn't make it for the Paris Olympics, and as you said, it was very, very tight, and that it wasn't entirely your fault, because in the run up to that, the whole Jewish world had this awful thing of October 7th. So explain to us how that affected you and affected what it meant to actually try and get to the Olympics under these kind of conditions.
Right. So 9 months before the Olympics, October 7th happened. We were, as a national team in Canada at the time, racing for a World Cup as part of the Olympic campaign. And we had to race the World Cup on October 8th. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. Obviously, for some time, it hurt the results. Obviously, it was very, very hard to concentrate. But on the other hand, it was also like we had a lot to prove. You know, it also in a way made us angry, and we channeled that to ride faster. We try. And when I came back home after that, it was a period of time I cannot even describe of being home in that time. But I found myself helping the communities that were attacked around the Gaza envelope, and that is the only thing that made me also still pursuing my own goals, because I couldn't, you know, just focus on myself and think about Olympics at that time. So I found this combination of riding with these communities, the youth that were attacked, and then training on my own. That was the way I found I can do it. Yeah, and then 9 months later, I was still very, very close to the Olympics. We continued racing, and then 3 weeks before the Olympics, it was the final final separation between me and the Belgian rider, that we were very tight head to head, and at the end she was better than me. But yeah, you can always think about what if, and if we didn't have October 7th, also we would have more funding still in sports, and of course more focus and more lighter hearts for sure. But it did happen, and we just move on and deal with it, I guess.
What does the cycling mean for the people in the Gaza Envelope communities?
It's an amazing project operated by the Bartali NGO. And I am so lucky to be a part of that. I didn't work in Bartali before. I only started working with them after 7th of October because of everything that happened. And I found an immediate connection, very strong connection to the communities and to the work. The connection was so strong, I even moved to the Gaza Envelope and living there until now to continue this project.
We're talking to Na'ama Neumann today. She is the Israeli champion in mountain biking. If you want to ask her any questions, 061-895-1019. And we're going to be continuing the conversation just after this.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
The Skim Wellness Clinic for Adults offers convenient and professional care to help you manage health risks. Whether you're having regular wellness checks, such as blood pressure or cholesterol, the Skim Wellness Clinics offers you a broad range of health screening services, including female health screening with pap smears, family planning, and pregnancy screening. Fast, affordable, and with care, find your nearest Dis-Chem Wellness Clinic inside. Dis-Chem Pharmacies, better health starts here. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Studio Plus 972. And we're talking to Na'ama Neumann today, who is the Israeli national champion in the discipline of mountain bike riding. Now, you're going to the Olympics. How long has this been an Olympic sport for?
Since 1996.
Oh, wow. So it's a proper established sport. You're not doing breakdancing or anything like that.
It's a discipline to stay.
Okay. No, that's good because, breakdancing was one of those things that caused some considerable issues in Paris. Now, before the break, we were talking about the question of training under October cloud of October 7th, shall we call it, and this amazing project that you were able to keep cycling and keep the dream alive. But one of the things that we've seen certainly in the diaspora has been this explosion in anti-Semitism, the targeting of Israelis abroad. Has that been something that's affected you in the biking community?
So we are more aware, and not always I'm wearing my national champion jersey where you see the Israeli flag very, very clearly across my chest and my back. So sometimes I choose to ask for permission not to race with it, actually. I don't like doing it, but sometimes,
depending on where you are.
Yeah, my safety comes first after all, and I'm alone most of the times, and it's enough one crazy person following me to the hotel or whatever, and I don't want to risk it sometimes. Depends where I am. But other than that, I'm very, very proud to wear my national jersey flag and race with it across the world. But I haven't experienced any direct issues with it so far, but we did have one incident of the national team race pit getting completely vandalized and broken, some stuff there. That I actually think it was even before the war.
Mm-hmm. You've referred in the conversation several times in the plural. You talk about we. So, like, you're the only racer, as far as I know, and I've seen biking things on the road with these teams. But explain to me what we looks like in the context of a biking scenario.
Actually, a good question. So I'm not always in a we, but we are a community of very few racers from Israel, and we stick together, we support each other, and we all go through similar things. Here, for example, I'm on my own, but I'm not really on my own. I have the community taking care of me, and it always takes a village. We say, like, from the start line onwards, I'm on my own, but I don't get there on my own, you know.
And in terms of the team that works with you, do you have a coach? Do you have a nutritionist? Do you have a mental? But, like, how does that work in terms of the Olympics?
So I have a coach, and I have a nutritionist, and I have a physiotherapist. But I see them very rarely, you know. Like, physiotherapist, obviously, a bit more. We have appointments, but nutritionist and coach is completely digital. We never meet, basically.
And there's no Rosh Schlepp, you know, there's no one bringing the food or the bike along, whatever. You've got to organize all the logistics and figure out the flights and all of that.
That's all on my own. That's all on my own, all the managing. At the moment, also the funding is all me.
And you talked about the nutritionist. What does a biker eat in order to do what you do?
Carbs.
Really? Is it just carbs?
No, I mean, of course, we eat very balanced nutrition, but we do emphasize carbs in order to recover and to fuel for the next ride.
Because you must burn a hell of a lot on something like a Cape Epic.
Cape Epic is a different story. You eat everything you can see at the time.
So, all right. So you're talking now about the Olympics. That's 28, it seems like far away, but I imagine in racing terms, it's probably not. So explain to us what that looks like, the process, till that period.
As a rider that rides from 10 years old and dreams about Olympics since 12-year-old, maybe it's 2 years is like nothing. It's a heartbeat. It's like I can't believe it's been a long-term goal and suddenly it's such a short-term goal. I need to have goals also after. 2 years is nothing in terms of a goal, let's say, but at the end, it's the next 2 years is going to be racing almost every week, different place in the world. You have to be on top of your game. You have to be focused. You have to be fit and healthy, not to get injured. And it's like being completely locked in. So everything else in your life is secondary at best at this moment.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke about the funding. I'm assuming that really covers the logistics of getting to the different places to do all these qualifying, is that correct?
That's the bulk of it, yeah.
And how does it work? You sort of intimated that the government sometimes does support, or that there is support in Israel, which sort of disappeared. How have you generally gotten to this place so far?
So since the war, we have less, the sports ministry just get less from the government, and then it's slowly dripping from one to one to one, and everybody gets a bit less. So it's not a support that can handle a whole Olympic campaign.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite minor. They do what they can. But as athletes, all of us are also looking for private funding as well.
Okay, so whilst you've been out here in South Africa, you have done pitching to some different people. I'm not sure you actually brought out here by the Israel Center, but you when you arrived, they sort of had to look after you a little bit because you weren't been able to go back. But I understand that the local community here is able to take donations on behalf for your race that's going on. Is that correct?
That's correct. And we will be very, very grateful for any kind of support. You know, it doesn't have to be to start with big numbers, but we do need to kickstart this Olympic campaign.
Okay, so that's a really important thing. So if you want to assist, you can get hold of the Israel Center and talk to Avi, and I'm sure he'll be able to point you in the right direction if you want to support Nama. And have the fact, you know, it's always great for us when we have Israelis win things in the Olympics, and it always tends to be disciplines that are like, I won't say alternative, but it's always like the windsurfers and the judoicas and these like niche disciplines that take this kind of focus. So I think we should add mountain biking to the list, only with gold. That's everything else is not acceptable. So in terms of just putting everything on the line, as we've got kind of the last minute before the end of the show, what would you have to say to someone who really is dreaming about something and just really wants it? This is clearly something that you're putting everything on the line for. What would you say to people out there who are dreaming about something and want to take it?
First, I want to say dream big. Don't be scared. Because the worst thing, you walk away with the same you had before. And most of the time you walk away with much more. And I fell in love with the journey, not just dreaming about the goal, also walking towards the goal, and that's what makes me living my dream at the moment. Dream, and you never know. You never know when is your next good day, next good race, next dream you achieve, and you just have to keep believing and walking towards it.
Amazing. If you want to check out Nama Neumann, you can check her out on Instagram. She's got a a regular updated Instagram, which is mostly her covered in mud, but it's still very interesting to see, and you can follow her journey. And if you want to donate, check out the Israel Center, and they'll be able to support Naama. Best of luck with your Olympic journey. I can tell you that the Chai FM community is definitely going to be following and supporting you all the way. We're going to be back just after this.
Chai FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
101.9 Chai FM, I'm Benji Shulman, and this is Plus 972 Studio. Now, from the interview, Avi from the Israel Center is actually giving me the correct details. So if you want to get in touch with the team, it's b.schneider@jnfsa.co.za. That's Bev Schneider. She will be able to assist you. Just get hold. It's actually via the JNF. I got that wrong, via the Israel Center. So if you want to get hold of Bev from the JNF, or just go to the JNF website, and they'll be able to help you with if you want to make any funding available. But I thought that was a very great interview. Now, it is the Omer, and that is the time between Pesach and Shavuot. And as a result, one of the practices, there's a kind of a morning practice, although it's not strictly a morning time, and that has to do with events that were happening in the Jewish world at the time, and different elements, and it's quite complicated, and we have excellent rabbis on this radio show, which will help explain it to you, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more about it. But one of those practices is that we don't listen to as much music, particularly instrumental music, and instead we listen to a cappella music. I call it alpaca music, because sometimes it does sound a little bit like a bunch of alpacas got together to do some singing. And someone was complaining to me the other night that they find a cappella music boring and a little bit sad and a little bit not great. So I thought, no, we can't have this. So I thought, what is the craziest a cappella song that I can come up with? And we're going to play it on the show as the outgoing song for today. And that song, I've decided, is going to be something by the German band called Rammstein. If you grew up like I did 20 years ago, Rammstein was like the biggest German band that there was, and they're really aggressive, and they have, it's like very Germanic, basically, right? This is what you expect from the Germans. So it's big and it's bold. It's a little bit, dare I say, smidgen fascist. I don't know. They probably wouldn't appreciate me saying that, but whatever. There is Rammstein. And what I thought is, let's see if we can get the Rammstein a cappella song. And that is what we've managed to do. So I'm going to be playing out with some Rammstein today. Thank you to everyone for joining us on the show. Thank you to Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons and has really been a one-man band today. He has been the sound guy, and the Avusi is, I'm sure, will be doing the sound, but Craig has to do that sort of thing as well. He's had to let people in and out the studio, run the whole place, because it has been a public holiday. So he's had a long day. So thank you especially to Craig. Thank you to Avusi, who does do the sound. And thank you to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week. I can't even see Dylan Berger here. He's not in the studio. Although I can see Simon Anstey, who's going to be joining you for the home run for the rest of the day. Although I can't imagine the traffic is going to be too hectic. But basically, thank you to you, dear listener, for joining us every single week. Do join us again next week on Plus 97 Studio.